This is Deborah Beck, professor of ancient Greek literature in the Department of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin. My students and I are excited to welcome you to our podcast, Musings in Greek Literature. Welcome to episode 2 of season 3 of Musings in Greek Literature. I'm Professor Deborah Beck, and I am absolutely delighted to be here with Dr. Rebecca Vanderhorst. Dr. Vanderhorst earned her PhD in classical philology from the University of Texas at Austin in 2019, where she wrote a fantastic dissertation on Apollonius under my direction. I learned a lot from her while she was writing her dissertation about Apollonius, especially about the nature of heroism and about the way Apollonius weaves that into the poem. And I'm delighted to be hosting this episode with her today, which focuses on book 2 of the Argonautica, because I find book 2 to be the most difficult book in the poem to really get a handle on. And one of the most helpful things for me in trying to understand what it's about has been talking with Becca about it when she was writing her dissertation and over the years since then. So welcome, Becca. Thank you for being here. Would you like to introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners?
Sure. First of all, thank you for inviting me. It's fun to chat about the Argonautica again. So I did write my dissertation on Apollonius's Argonautica, specifically on heroism, as you just mentioned, Deborah. And then I taught at Trinity University for 3 semesters before deciding to move to Idaho.
For those of you who are not in the middle of Texas, there are several Trinity universities around the country. This is the one in San Antonio.
Yes. And great experience there. I decided to move closer to family, though, and Idaho is not exactly a bastion for classical studies. So right now, still trying to figure out exactly what I'll be doing for a long-term profession, but enjoying my time here.
Excellent. Well, delighted that your schedule has room for us in it. So we've been talking a lot, as we were just kind of chatting about book 2 before we started our recording, about the way that there's no single through line for book 2. With all the other books of the poem, it's fairly easy to make a general summarizing statement about it. Book 1 is about, you know, the journey towards Colchis, and there's a couple of marquee stories in it where you can say, oh, book 1 is the one where he visits the Lemnian women or something like that. And book 2 is just not like that. There isn't a single Argonaut that has a, you know, sustained central role. And it just kind of feels like you're on a long bus ride to Colchis. This is this stop. This is that stop. This is some other stop. I'm really glad to have you here to help figure it out. I mean, I think there are some themes, some of which we take on in progress from book 1. So as an example, Jason continues repeatedly to be the hero who is a mechanos, who has trouble coming up with plans and responses to challenges that the Argonauts find themselves in over and over again at some, you know, juncture where they have to figure out what to do. Jason wrings his hands and says, oh no, what do we do? And some other Argonaut says, no problem, we'll just do fill in the blank. And then they do that. There's also, as there always is when Jason and the Argonauts are traveling around, etiologies, stories that explain the origin of something that the contemporary reader of the Argonautica, so someone in the 3rd century BCE, might know from their own life. And so those are some things that we see in book 2 that we're already familiar with from book 1. But there's also some themes in book 2 that really take on some kind of new or unique life, right, in book 2. So tell us about some of those.
Yeah, well, first of all, I completely agree with you. Book 1 is, it's also so focused on the idea, the kind of conflict between violent measures and kind of more creating relationships with other people and with each other. And that is just this constant theme throughout. Whereas, as you're saying, book 2 is just like, blah, throw everything at the board. And it's just like, oh, and here we are at this location, and here's where these people live, and here's where these people live, and so forth. But there are two themes, like you were saying, that are kind of unique to book two, that are kind of more kind of focuses, but not quite the same focus as like violence in book one. But one of those is religion becomes, it takes on kind of a different role than it does in book one. You know, with book one, you have such a focus at the beginning where Athena herself helped them build the ship. And so you have kind of this close relationship with the gods, but they also don't show up very often. So it's really like stuff that happened before the journey or the very end of the book with the sea god who just pops up out of the water and says, hello, Heracles is to stay, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in book two, you actually have more religious episodes, but it starts to really hit on the idea that there's always this kind of shroud between the mortal sphere and the divine sphere. So for example, we see Phineas, where Phineas is a prophet early on in book two, who gives a lot of information to the Argonauts about what they need to do to go from point A to get to Colchis and various things they need to do and whatnot. But he's also been cursed because he, as a prophet, did not respect the kind of boundaries that Zeus wants to have in place. So he was telling everyone everything about the future. Whereas according to Phineas, Zeus wanted to have little bits of things that were still mysteries. And so he cursed Phineas with blindness and with being attacked by harpies and whatnot. And so there's this strong idea that you can't know everything about the gods. And then just a couple other examples. You have during the Clashing Rock scene, a great epic moment when the Argo is going through these huge clashing rocks. Athena helps them through it, but they don't know that she helps. And at the end, Tiphys is like, oh, thanks to Athena. And at first you're like, wow, good, he knew. But then he says, thanks to Athena because she built a great ship. So that's not why they got through the clashing rocks. It's because Athena actually came down and shoved them through.
Yeah.
But Tiphys doesn't know that. And so it's this weird, almost like comical, ironic moment where the audience knows actually Athena really did help. Yeah. But Tiphys just says, she helped build us a great ship. Well done, Athena. Yeah. Yeah. And it's just this weird kind of relationship. Or even like when Idmon dies, there's this repeated kind of insistence in book two that religion is present. It's there. We have the epiphany of Apollo, even though there's no actual like conversation or anything.
Right. He just shows up and is impressive and then he goes away again. Yeah.
But there's this very kind of stark separation between mortal and divine that's starting to be developed in this book.
Absolutely. And
the last thing I would say is that you see increasingly un-Greek behavior the closer you get to Colchis. So the further you get from Iolcus, closer to Colchis, things start getting weirder and weirder. So of course we have the Amazonian women, which are kind of like the Lemnian women in that they are a culture of women. Except the Amazons are even less Greek. You know, they have no agriculture. They have no herding and whatnot. Whereas the Lemnian women, at least they were still doing Greek things.
Right.
Like
right.
having a discussion with each other and whatnot.
Right. And then so the thing that's wrong with the Lemnian women is the women are doing male things. But the basic ways you run society are recognizably Greek. Whereas the Amazons have totally like gone completely random by Greek cultural standards. And they're missing these basic cultural markers of civilized behavior. The Lemnian women are just having the wrong gender doing the things, but the Amazons have dumped just qualitatively a different level of societal, as it were, normalcy that a Greek would expect.
Absolutely. And you just have more and more of those people like, oh goodness, I don't even know how to, the Mycenaeans, I think it is. You know, the ones who do everything outdoors that should be done in private. So like having sex and stuff, they do it out of doors, which the Greeks would have been like, nah, that's not
what could be weirder than that. Yeah. No.
And the king who lives in a tall tower. And so if he doesn't give a good adjudication, they won't feed the king who's in the tower. So, I mean, it's just these kind of weird stories that especially start around like line 950 or whatever. So once again, right as you're getting up to Colchis, just the stories of weirdness kind of proliferate to just show that we're entering a region that is not Greek. It is not the familiar kind of Grecian standards and whatnot.
And I think we mentioned this in episode one, but in case we didn't, Colchis is located on the shores of the Black Sea, on the eastern end of the Black Sea. So this is very far from what was familiar territory for the Greeks. So if you happen to have an atlas handy, and maybe we'll actually put a link to a map in the show notes, I think we should do that. Greece is like in the middle of the, sort of halfway across the Mediterranean from east to west. And the Black Sea is way far to the east of that. So this is very distant, both geographically and just in terms of, you know, thinking culturally about who lives where for the Greeks. Colchis is very far away. Right. And you were also, as you were talking about the religion thing in particular, I was thinking that there's absolutely that religion specific representation of the separation between what the gods think should be happening or know is happening and what mortals are allowed to know. But I think there's a kind of comparable strand in the narrative itself, where Apollonius is consistently using allusions to earlier literature that he's expecting his readers to know about in order to create a similar gulf between our knowledge of the plot as readers. Looking ahead to when Medea and Jason finally meet in book three, Medea thinks this is this wonderful, happy event for her. And yet Apollonius uses these very rich and complex Homeric allusions to say to things that in Homer turned out really badly for the people involved, to say, yeah, well, Medea thinks this is great, but you, reader, who recognize my allusions, know that she is sadly mistaken about that. So I think it's really interesting to think about how, you know, that specific orientation towards the dangerousness or the inappropriateness of humans knowing too much about the gods. There's also, I think, a sense in Apollonius that the characters are defined as characters in part by their incomplete knowledge, not just of religious things or the future or whatever, but just of anything that's happening to them whatsoever. And the gods are kind of a particularly pronounced example of that.
Yeah, very well put. And also, as you guys discussed in the first episode, also that Apollonius kind of gives even the reader piecemeal information sometimes. Like you don't actually understand the importance for the Golden Fleece until like end of book two, I think it is. You know, so it's, you also are getting just kind of this piecemeal information as a reader, and Apollonius is kind of giving it to you when he wants to. So it's a fascinating way to kind of play with knowledge and lack of knowledge on so many different fronts.
Sure. Yeah. And as you imply, that always is going to highlight the presence of the narrator as the person who is kind of, you know, facilitating or impeding the process of understanding who knows what and comparing that to what, quote unquote, is really happening, whatever that means in a fictional narrative. Speaking of fictional narratives, let's turn our attention to a specific narrative so that we can sort of delve in more detail into something that happens in book two and how we see some of these themes playing out there. So the first thing that happens in the poem is that they land in the kingdom of the Bebrycians, which is ruled by King Amycus, or Amycus, depending on how you want to transliterate his Greek name. And he, let's just say, is not a paragon of awesomeness at all. So tell me about your take on that episode. I know you have a lot of interesting ideas about it.
Yeah, well, it's this fascinating episode because at the end of book one, we've lost Heracles, which, as you guys looked at the election scene at Iolcus that happens, early in book one, when Jason is like, choose the best man, ton oriston, to lead our expedition. And all the young guys are like, Heracles. And then, you know, Heracles is like, no, give it to Jason. But in book one, he has been kind of this leader for the Argonauts. Even though Jason is the leader, Heracles has very much been the leader behind the leader. And so he's been the ton oriston for the group. Even at the end of book one, after they've lost Heracles, they're like, oh no, we lost ton oriston. They use that word again at the end of book one, saying we've lost the best man. And so now you open book two with this scary dude saying, I have this law that no one can pass me without sending someone to wrestle with me to the death, basically. And, you know, at first, you know, you think, well, this is a perfect thing for Heracles to do, right? I mean, at the end of the event, actually, they're like, well, gosh darn, I wish Heracles had been with us, because then none of this would have happened because they would have been so scared of him. Right. So this is a really pinnacle moment, though. They've just lost their best fighter, the person who was this most heroic figure, mythically, historically, everything. And now you've got this really scary guy saying, I need to fight with someone. And he specifically says, and this is in line 15 at the start of this book, and it's even in line, same position as it was when Jason said, send me Tonaris, or choose Tonariston to be our leader. Amicus says, choose Tonariston to fight me. And so there's this really fascinating thing that Heracles, the best man of the group, is gone. And then Amicus comes up and says, give me your best man, and gone. So we need a new one. And
who is that? We don't even know.
Exactly. But Polydeuces, who is also a son of Zeus, like Heracles was. And the way he fights, though, and the type of heroic figure he is very different from book one's best man, Heracles. Where Heracles is all about strength and rage and emotion and senseless, you know, you know, the event where he left the book, where he's just in this senseless rage and just wandering everywhere.
And he left the book, let's clarify, because people might think this is a euphemism for he died. No, we mean literally was lost. They misplaced him when they were getting ready to leave. Everybody thought he was somewhere else, and they didn't realize they'd left him behind until they were already embarked. And then everybody's like, crap, who left Heracles behind? So that's just a piece of, you know, sort of a giant oopsie moment for the Argonauts rather than some tragic incident where Heracles met a sad death or something like that. That's not what happens. Anyway, he's lost, literally. Now they have this challenge from Amicus that requires physical strength to meet it. And who's going to do that? So Polydeuces shows up, and what does he do? How does he wield his physical strength as compared to the way Heracles might have done the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, he still has strength, right?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
It's so different. You know, at the very beginning when he starts to fight, this is around kind of line 45-ish. It talks about how he swung his arms to test them and see if they moved as nimbly as before and were not heavy from both toil and rowing. But Amicus didn't do that, right? Because he just wants to fight, right? And then looking a little further on, we also have, once they start actually fighting, and this is right around number line 70, there's a simile that kind of compares the two, right? So thereupon, the king of the Bebrycians, so that's Amicus, as when a rough wave of the sea rears up against a swift ship, which barely escapes through the expertise of the wise helmsman as the billow strives to sweep over its sides. Thus did he pursue the son of Tyndareus, that would be Polydeuces, to frighten him and allowed him no respite. But Polydeuces, ever uninjured, kept evading his onslaught through his skill. And those last three words, through his skill.
Yeah.
The Greek there is dia maten. And matis is a fascinating word when you come to heroic figures. It means so many different things. It's it can mean kind of like using intellect and strategy. It can mean more kind of negative traits of that. So more like cunning or ambush sort of stuff. Yep. Or it can also just be like the intellect and skill that's required for a carpenter to make something. So it's a really powerful word in ancient Greek thought. The attribute most associated with Athena, for example, and also Odysseus. But that's the kind of figure we have here. We have someone who is still strong, still powerful, but he is a figure who has moderated that strength in a way that we don't see with Heracles, who's all just about bashing people in the head, but instead is using caution and patience and is kind of, sizing up. That's what the next section is talking about, how he sizes up the other person's style of boxing. And only once he understood what the weakness and strengths are, did he finally start engaging this wave of nature, right? A micus,
right.
With the intelligence that you would see with a helmsman, for example, or
Absolutely.
Just with this metis.
Yeah. And I just love that helmsman simile because
oh, yeah.
the wave is depicted as almost this like sentient being. The yeah. wave is described as eager to jump into the ship. So just as there's this emphasis on the cleverness, the expertise, the strategy of Polydeuces and how that sets him apart, as you say, from what Heracles would have done. So also there's this consistent focus on the sort of animal brutality of Amycus. So he's a person, obviously, but he shows up in the poem at the very beginning. He introduces himself as a person who scorns the basic fabric of human society when he says, I don't care about, you know, welcoming guests in the societally appropriate way, which is to feed them and, you know, make them comfortable and then ask them about themselves. You're absolutely not supposed to impose tests on your visitors, or still less are you supposed to threaten them with physical harm. I mean, hospitality was so basic to Greek culture that it was one of the things that Zeus was the god of, you know, the most important yeah. god of to the Greeks. So here's Amycus basically putting a sign on his head saying, I'm an uncivilized, barbaric jerk. And the simile, I think, by, you know, likening him to this wave, which itself is very sort of human in its desire to jump into the boat, really helps us to think of him as this force of nature, as distinct from Polydeuces, who's this clever, planful guy, distinguished, we might in fact say, not only from Amycus, who he clearly is very different from, but even from Jason, who whenever he's confronted with a problem just goes, oh no. And someone else has to come along and say, here's the plan. Here's the metis that we're going to use to get out of this. Jason never comes up with the metis. Someone else is always having to do that for him.
No, absolutely. In several of those comparisons you made, but also with just like that you were kind of touching on, Amycus also just being like a Heracles figure, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. at the end of book one of the last similes we get for Heracles as he's ripping up this tree in order to fashion an oar because he broke his oar is of this wave, you know, sweeping on the wind on the ocean and ripping out the mast of a tree. So you have, you know, these two figures, Amycus and Heracles, who are both compared to these naturalistic, scary forces.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of other similarities too, with like both of them being called monstrous Pelor. And then they're both very much engaged with fighting. The Bebrycians in general use clubs and stuff, which is very much Heraclean.
Yeah.
And so you have, you know, in book one, Heracles equals the best. Then you've got Polydeuces coming in, who is not like Heracles at all and defeats this Heraclean figure mm-hmm. almost to just say Heracles doesn't fit here
right.
At all. And then just your comparison with Polydeuces also being very different from Jason is something that I think we'll look at a lot probably in book three with your students yeah. talking about it. But yeah, absolutely on all those fronts. So it's almost like the start of book two is saying, okay, Glaucus just told you that Heracles is out of the book. And now we're telling you he's really out of the book. And now it's this new kind of hero type that is a bit more refined, a bit more kind of intellectual that is now predominant as the leading and guiding force of the Argonautic group.
Awesome.
Book two is weird in that, yes, it doesn't have a unifying hero. And it has a lot of different themes. But once you kind of start looking at the heroic moments, it does mm-hmm. have this huge focus on skill and metis, which I find rather fascinating. And especially when compared to the Iliad and the Odyssey, which mm-hmm. arguably, looking at the heroes there, the Iliad being focused on a hero of warfare and might, whereas the Odyssey focusing on a hero of metis. And so mm-hmm. books one and two kind of showing two different heroic models that you can pursue.
Absolutely. Both of which have precedence in Homer. And Apollonius, I imagine, expected the reader to be aware of that. But Apollonius is pursuing them in his own very Apollonius kind of way. And as you were saying that, I was actually thinking that the thing they say as their boat is parked there in the river off of Colchis and they're figuring out what to do kind of sets the tone for the way that book three is going to imagine heroism, because what they say there is they anchor the ship and they decide whether they should try melichie in line 1279, which means kind of nice, sweet, persuasive, gentle speech with Thyestes, who's the king there, or they should do something else. And there's so many different places in book three where it's neither physical strength nor metis nor cleverness, but melichie, sort of, charm, we might say, that the characters use to try to get things done.
Well, absolutely. And now that you're bringing up book three, you turn to book three, which starts with a new invocation, and it does make a huge shift in what is the focus. So book one, you have violence, Heracles, martial stuff, and then kind of this contrast with Jason trying to create more of a commonality thing, but failing so often around Heracles. And then book two, having all of this kind of skill-based heroics. And then you get to book three with the invocation. And do you want to lead that off, Deborah, chatting
about
it?
Yeah, sure.
It's just so wonderful.
Yeah. So book three is the part of the poem that the people, so Apollonius's Argonautica is not a poem that is widely known in the general world. Classicists know about it, but people who don't study Latin and Greek professionally often don't, even if they are familiar with the myth of Jason and the Argonauts or the myth of Jason and Medea. But book three, which focuses mainly on the story of how Jason and Medea fall in love and Medea helps Jason to eventually use magic. She gives him magic that helps him to win the golden fleece, begins with this very striking invocation that in fact set the tone later for the way Virgil did invocations in the Aeneid. So Apollonius begins, "Come now, Erato," when he speaks directly to a female divine figure. He doesn't speak to some muse or goddess, which is the figures that are addressed at the beginning of the Iliad and the Odyssey. He speaks to a female personification of sexual desire. So, Erato, stand by my side and tell me how from here, that is to say, from here where the boat is parked, and also from here in the poem, Jason brought the golden fleece back to Iolcos, his home in Greece, with the aid of Medea's love, Mede Aesop Eroti. So again, that word eros for sexual love. And then there's a little address, direct address to Erato and why she's the person that might be addressed here. But this is very clearly saying this part of the story is about actually getting a fleece, doing the heroic exploit that this whole poem is about, but we're doing it not either by physical strength that we talked about in book one or the metis, the cleverness that was the focus of book two. Now we're getting everything done with eros. So we're in another new universe as compared to either book one or book two.
Yeah. And just the way that Apollonius does this, it's just masterful. You know, like you talked about in the first one about how book one's invocation is a little unusual with the way that it sets up the relationship between the muse and the poet and how it's very much focused on the poet. You know, I will recall the famous deeds of men and so forth. Mm-hmm. So now you've got, come here, Erato, this one of the muses that's associated with love and whatnot. Stand by my side and tell me. And it even has the enespemoi, which is the verb I think that's used in the Odyssey, right? Tell to me this thing. So I'm sure people may have thought, oh, this is sounding a bit like Odysseus, except for that weird Erato. I don't know what's going on there. Yep. And then you keep on going, right? The next line tell me how. From here, Jason brought the fleece back to Iolcos. And it ends with Jason's name in that line, Jason. Mm-hmm. And so they may have thought, oh yeah, this is good. It's focused on our masculine hero accomplishing his journey. And then it appends in the very next line with Medea's name in the front with the aid of Medea's love. And right there, we've got a new hero. And I mean, Odysseus is always kind of associated with women as well, but
sure is.
It's different. It's kind of more about undercutting their strength, undercutting their power and showing his own supremacy as a masterful, cunning person and kind of deflating female power. Whereas here, this is Medea, almost like this equal. You know, you've got Jason mm-hmm. in line end position, Medea in line initial position, and she is the one who is making this happen. So yeah. It is introducing a different sort of heroic figure who is depending on women. And mm-hmm. as it progresses, then you guys will be talking in future podcasts, I imagine, very much dependent on female goddesses and female figures like Calliope and whatnot. Yeah. And then also just this whole love thing that is slightly different from kind of the way that Odysseus sometimes uses his relationships with women.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the emotional tie between Jason and Medea is as important a part of book three as the help Medea gives him for his heroic activity, getting the golden fleece. So there's sort of like two different strands almost of heroism. There's Medea's awesomeness, which many scholars have called heroism, where yeah. through a combination of her love for Jason and her magical powers, it's really she who allows this quest to succeed. And then on the other hand, here's Jason, who is praised repeatedly in book three for being incredibly physically attractive. That's not something anybody ever says about Odysseus. I mean, Odysseus gets things done because he has, you know, strengths of various kinds, but his physical attractiveness is never one of them. Until the very end of the Odyssey, when he becomes physically attractive, not as a sign of his own power, but as a sign of the power of Athena, who for the earlier part of the poem has disguised him as an old man so that he doesn't get killed or prematurely exposed as having returned home. And so Jason's physical appearance is a kind of power of his and an aspect of his heroism in a way that has no parallel at all in either Achilles or Odysseus. I mean, they're physically impressive, but not because they're cute, because yeah. they're strong or they're something else. And so, you know, the sort of emotional dimension of this kind of love is a new thing in epic poetry. It's not at all a new thing in Greek literature. It was very much at home in lyric poetry, in Greek tragedy. And there's a very important sense, of course, in which this poem is a fan fiction prequel to Euripides' Medea, his tragedy about Medea, and what happens when Medea and Jason have returned to Greece and things go horribly wrong. But I think you're absolutely right that the word order here absolutely, in addition to the content itself, sets Medea up as just as important and just as powerful and heroic and generally awesome as Jason. And the reason for that is both of their connection, participation in activities of Eros. Mm-hmm. Not of metis, not of physical strength, not of cleverness. And interestingly enough, you know, there are still moments when Jason is amechanas, when he's clueless, but there are a lot fewer. He's in some sense, I think, a lot more adept at being a hero of erotic love than he is at being a hero of any of the things that have gone on in books one and two.
Yes, yes. And pleasant speech, like you were saying at the end.
Pleasant speech, yes.
Book two. I mean, that's kind of, and just forging agreements with people by using yeah. his kind of silvery tongue, which is once again, like Odysseus, but not exactly. I mean, Jason is always like, let's be friends. Let's find the commonality between all of us and seek after harmony and whatnot. Whereas Odysseus, you know, famously not 100% crew focused, shall we say.
Oh, whereas really Jason, not. Absolutely.
Jason very much is. So he has so many similarities to Odysseus, so mm-hmm. many, but they yeah. are all just shaped slightly differently to make Jason a very, very different heroic figure from
absolutely.
Either of the major heroic figures of right. Homeric epic.
Right. So we'll be exploring in more detail in the rest of the podcasts in this season. All but one of them are going to have a different form than these first two episodes have had. We're going to have the next five episodes in this season are going to be produced by undergraduates who are taking a class with me right now on Apollonius's Argonautica. Each one of them is going to focus on a small piece of book three. We do not expect an undergraduate to discourse about the entirety of any book of the Argonautica. They're going to bite off smaller pieces than the graduate students and I are talking about. And then we're going to explore a lot of the themes that we've opened up in books one, book two, in these individual scene focuses that the undergraduates are going to produce. So, Becca, let's think for a minute. I mean, having now, you know, actually done the podcast, let's think for more about that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that drew me to this epic to begin with is that it is not as commonly read, not as commonly studied, because it is so complex in different ways than the Iliad and the Odyssey are. And I just really appreciated some of the things that you and Bill were chatting about in your first podcast about ways to make it more kind of relatable for students and kind of encouraging them to focus on what's actually important. And I think one of the things I also like to do, especially with this epic, is, and I think one of the things that really drew it to me, is this concept of heroism. Because mm-hmm. heroism is something that is such a prevalent topic for various ages, various cultures and whatnot. We've had our own kind of heroism explosion, explosion of the heroic genre, I guess you could say, in our own modern world since, you know, roughly 2000 with the explosion of Marvel and, and DC and all of this stuff. And so I really like to think about this story in a way that connects with our modern day experiences of asking ourselves, what is a hero? Is it someone like Heracles, who is strength and bashing people in the skull? Is it someone like Polydeuces, who, you know, uses intellect but still has the strength to bash people in the head? Yeah. Or is it someone like Jason, who is, he gets depressed. He talks to people. He's handsome and likes to make relationships and whatnot. And, you know, for Apollonius's age, they would have said Jason, you know, because Jason was very much a product of his era, of the Hellenistic age. And so I like thinking of this story as a story of heroes, in that it also speaks to what we see in a hero. That of these three heroic types, of any of them, I think a modern audience would also kind of feel gravitated towards Jason as a heroic type. But that in modern heroes, we also like to see things like self-sacrifice and, you know, things that you don't see with ancient heroes. Right. And so I love looking at heroes because it is one of the most profound ways I have found in teaching to address culture and cultural differences. And not just cultural differences, but also cultural differences through time. I mean, there are reasons why heroes like Spider-Man or Superman came into being at the eras they did in the 1900s, with various things going on in the world that made the, you know, people more interested in various different types of heroes. And so I think for me, with teaching an epic like this, I find it so valuable in terms of making it more approachable for modern audiences by thinking of ways that it connects with our own culture and our own popular media.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I'm not going to say anything because I love that so much. As you say, thinking about what it means to be a hero is so, so productive, so fruitful for thinking about ourselves. Like, what do we think is important about being a person? What is difficult and or necessary about living together with other people? Because one of the things that characterizes ancient heroes a lot of the time is that the very thing that makes them heroic also makes it hard for them to live with other people comfortably.
Yes. And
that's such a great way to make this poem, which can seem sort of overwhelming to students, speak directly to something that virtually everyone right now has some acquaintance and or interest in, and that is heroes. Pretty much everybody alive who goes to the movies has at one time or another seen a Marvel movie. And that Argonautica is absolutely part of that conversation. You know, 2,500 years ago, it's a somewhat different conversation than it is now, but it's not that different. You know, speaking to the same questions, the same needs, the same aspirations for people that we have now, today.
Yes.
So thank you for saying that so beautifully. I said I wasn't going to say anything and then I did, which is kind of too
well,
bad.
It was well said. But yeah, I mean, Apollonia sat down and said, what does it mean to be a hero? And wrote an epic about heroism. And the exact same thing is happening in those Marvel studios. What does it mean? What will most resonate with people? And so, such a great reflection of society, but yes.
Well, Becca, as always, your ideas really resonate with me. It's been such a pleasure to sit and chat with you about Apollonius. Again, we used to do this regularly when you were writing your dissertation.
Yes.
And we haven't done that recently. This has been a wonderful treat for me. I hope our listeners have enjoyed it at least half as much as I did. For all y'all who are listening out there, if you like our podcast, please leave us a comment or leave us a review so that you can help other listeners to find us. Our next episode, episode 3, will be brought to you by Cade and his fellow student, Dylan. They'll be talking more about heroism, in fact. So we look forward to seeing you then. Thanks again, Becca.
Thank you.